If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Thanks for joining me on this episode of Behind the Lines. I'm Arthur Snell. Before we get started, I want to tell you about a podcast that I'm really enjoying at the moment. Disorder is a weekly podcast from Goalhanger, the makers of The Rest is Politics and The Rest is History. It's tackling the really big questions like, how did the world get so disordered? What are the fundamental principles behind our current era of geopolitics? And how do seemingly disparate challenges from AI to climate change to wars in the Middle East and Ukraine to tax havens to unregulated cyberspace, how do they all interact with each other and feed into our era of global enduring disorder? So check out the link in the show notes to follow the podcast immediately.
Along at that point came Mark Sykes, a young Conservative MP. He was in his mid-30s. He was Kitchener's military assistant and a man of considerable energy, if not talent, and somebody who also, well, he left people in the under the impression that he could speak both Arabic and Turkish, for example, when in fact his grasp of both those languages was pretty minimal. And in December 1915, he went into the cabinet meeting. He had a map with him, and he announced that he wanted to draw a line from the E of Acre to the last K in Kirkuk. Those are the exact words from the minutes of the meeting.
The crisis in Israel-Palestine continues, currently unfolding with the Israeli attack on Gaza, which was immediately preceded, of course, by the Hamas-led massacre in southern Israel. Unpicking the history and origins of these events remains a particularly difficult task, with history used and abused by people with points to prove on all sides. For that reason, I was particularly happy to be able to conduct an extended interview with the historian James Barr, whose books on the history of the Middle East, including A Line in the Sand and Lords of the Desert, are some of the best regarded guides to the region, particularly in the early years of the 20th century. With James in this first episode, we got to the bottom of famous moments in the Levant region in that era, including the Sykes-Picot Agreement and the Balfour Declaration, as well as the underlying colonial tensions, notably between Britain and France, that drove much of these events. In a subsequent episode, we will talk about Jewish militancy in the mid-20th century, the events of 1948, including the Nakba and the establishment of the State of Israel. I hope you find it interesting. Here's James. James, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Arthur. Thanks for having me.
So, James, we're obviously speaking in the wider context of the terrible events in Israel and Gaza and Israel's ongoing military operation there. And of course, across the Middle East, history always looms large. And some people take that history back thousands of years. And indeed, there's a, I think there's a video which has sort of been circulating on YouTube where Rory Stewart talks about the Israel-Palestine issue in the context of a 3,000-year history. But in a way, I think there are limitations with that, not the least of which is that nation states didn't exist at all, of course, 3,000 years ago and not even, you know, 300 years ago. So I was really keen to talk to you about the 20th century and the lead in to the 21st century. So perhaps we could start with that, the beginning of the 20th century. What was the basic situation in the place that is now Israel and Palestine and, of course, the wider Levant region?
So that part of the world 110 years ago or so was part of the Ottoman Empire, and it had been part of the Ottoman Empire since 1517. That's probably as far back as we need to go. In the 16th century, the Ottomans had expanded southwards. They took on the Mamluks, they defeated them, and then Palestine, as we think of it now, Israel-Palestine, came under Ottoman rule, and that's how it stayed for the next 400 years, with a bit of intermission from Napoleon and Mehmet Ali in the 19th century. But it was Ottoman controlled.
Yeah, and the population there, the majority of the people that lived there, would they have described themselves as Palestinians? And what religion were they? What languages did they speak?
So a real mixture. There were most people there were Arab Palestinians. They didn't necessarily see them. They probably saw themselves as Syrians, actually, at that time. That's probably the best way of describing them. Some of them were Sunni Muslims. Some of them were Christians. There was a real mixture of people in Jerusalem, just as you find today, people from all over the world had come there. And there was also a very small Jewish population, which had sometimes been there for quite a long time. Some Jews there were relatively recent arrivals. They were most of them were sort of experimental farmers. Actually, they founded communities toward the coast by and large, and they were growing oranges.
So you've mentioned the Jewish population there, and that's obviously hugely important. Clearly, you have the historic Kingdom of Israel, and there are plenty of archaeological remains of that. Before the late 19th century and the growth of the Zionist movement, the Jewish communities do exist across the Arab world, but they're concentrated in one or two areas, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, you find most of them were in... trying to remember, but Alexandria and Baghdad are two major centres. So, I mean, going right back, the Romans, after the Jewish revolts in the first and second centuries AD, the Romans forced the Jews to leave Judea, as it was then. So they had spread across the Middle East as well, and then subsequently, you know, much wider still.
Yeah. So then let's talk a little bit about Zionism, and that forces us to go back into the 19th century in the context of a lot of anti-Semitism across Europe, of course. And at that time, most Jews in the world were living in Europe. The idea of a return to the sort of biblical and historic homeland of the Jews became sort of a bit more lively. When did Jews start to move to what is now Israel in sort of substantial numbers?
So really only at the turn of the 20th century. The founder of Zionism generally is seen as Theodor Herzl.
Yeah.
But his campaign had not had a huge amount of success. So, I mean, that starts in the 1880s or so, and it hadn't really gained much traction. As you say, it was being driven by, you know, huge, deep anti-Semitism, particularly in Russia, but all across Eastern Europe. But many of the people who arrived in Palestine subsequently played a crucial role in the In the Zionist movement, people like David Ben-Gurion, for example, appeared at, you know, they were young people who came very early in the 20th century.
Yeah.
And it was only after that that, you know, that things really took off.
Yeah. And what sort of, they were leaving parts of largely of sort of Central Europe where anti-Semitism was a growing phenomenon.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I was just reading earlier on today about the man who steered a famous ship called the Exodus that we'll no doubt get onto. And he was born in Danzig, for example.
Right. Right. Which is now Gdansk in modern day Poland. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
So let's talk a bit about the events of the First World War, because that seems to crystallize some of what, you know, set into motion some of the sort of lines on a map that we now find in the Middle East. Lots of people, of course, know the story of Lawrence of Arabia and the Arab Revolt. And this was a group that was sort of unseating the Ottomans coming up from what is now Saudi Arabia. But what was going on in what is now the territory of Israel and Palestine during World War One?
So it was the subject of a dispute between the British and the French, which arose from a promise that the British made to persuade the Arabs to revolt. So, I mean, at the beginning of the war, one of Britain's neuroses was that there would be a jihad against them. So the Ottoman Sultan, who was the Ottomans on the German side, the Germans pressed the Sultan to announce this call to holy war, thinking that it would cause the populations of Egypt and India to rise up against the British, and that would divert British resources away from the Western Front.
Yeah.
So to blunt that, the British came up with the idea of encouraging the Sharif of Mecca to revolt against the Ottomans. Obviously, Mecca at the centre of the Muslim world, there could be no better illustration of the fact that not all Muslims, you know, would support the Sultan than if the Sharif revolted. And to persuade him to do that, they made this rather ill-advised and vague promise to him that they would give him a big empire after the war. And that included Israel, Palestine. Well, it depends. You can have a big, long argument about this. But it was deliberately vague. And in fact, the first person who was confused by its vagueness was the man who translated it into Arabic. So by the time it arrived with the Sharif, it read rather more forthrightly than the British had ever imagined it would. The consequences of that letter, or the thing that happened then, was that the French found out about what was going on. They picked up in Cairo that there'd been some sort of deal done, and that started to make them rather concerned, because they'd always been very suspicious of Britain's motives in the Middle East, going, you know, way back to the Napoleonic era. But in the First World War, in the context of the First World War, Britain had shown this strange interest in attacking Gallipoli at the beginning of 1915. And the French, essentially, it was done because they weren't making any headway on the Western Front. But it was when the British came up with this sort of grand idea, the French immediately thought that the empire building lay behind it.
Yeah.
And so the French were very anxious to get some sort of agreement on what would happen to the sort of post-Ottoman world. And in the funny way that these sort of bureaucratic initiatives develop a momentum which kind of lasts long after they've actually become irrelevant, even though Gallipoli was a complete fiasco, and by the middle of 1915 it was quite clear there wasn't going to be a breakthrough, it wasn't going to result in the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, the British and the French were still arguing over what would happen to the Ottomans' Middle Eastern territory. A man called François-Georges Picot, a very sort of angular and rather awkward French diplomat, arrived in London to press the case. And he had a series of meetings with British officials from the various government departments concerned. They were all rather one-sided. You get the impression that he was sitting on one side of a long table and these various Brits were on the other side. And he insisted that there was a need for some sort of deal because up to that point in the war, France had suffered far, far more casualties than Britain had. And Georges Picot used this to sort of, as a lever to force the British into talks. And this also came at a very awkward time, because this is in the run-up to the Battle of the Somme. The everyone who had wanted to volunteer to fight in the war had volunteered really by that point, or the vast majority of them, and they were all being trained for that battle in 1916. And the British government was actually now starting to think about the awkward need to conscript people, and that was the political priority. So Georges Picot and all this came at a rather, you know, it was rather unwelcome intrusion into more serious government business.
Yeah.
Along at that point came Mark Sykes, a young Conservative MP. He was in his mid-30s. He was Kitchener's military assistant and a man of considerable energy, if not talent, and somebody who also, well, he left people in the under the impression that he could speak both Arabic and Turkish, for example, when in fact his grasp of both those languages was pretty minimal. But he had travelled very widely through the Middle East before the war. He'd written a couple of books on the subject, so he was, as far as anyone could see, an expert on the subject. Yeah. And in December 1915, he went into the cabinet meeting. He had a map with him, and he announced that he wanted to draw a line from the E of Acre to the last K in Kirkuk. Those are the exact words from the minutes of the meeting.
Right.
And he said that if Britain and France split the Middle East down this line and France had the territory north of that line, Britain got what was to the south, then that would resolve matters, he thought, with the French.
Yeah.
And the politicians said, well, jolly good, if you know what you seem to know what you're talking about, you go off and speak to Georges Picot. And so Sykes, who lived on Buckingham Gate, just opposite Buckingham Palace, at that time, he had a series of meetings with Georges Picot, which led to the Sykes-Picot agreement. And so France got the sort of territory. It was a great swathe of territory, including northern Iraq, but now Syria and Lebanon as well.
Yeah.
Britain was going to get Israel, Palestine, Jordan and southern Iraq.
Yeah.
Well, actually, that's not quite true, actually. So hang on, let's just rewind that. So right. under the terms of the deal, so Sykes drew the line from Acre to Kirkuk, and the territory north of that line was going to go to France, and everything south of that, bar Israel-Palestine, would go to the British, because with Israel-Palestine, they couldn't reach an agreement. So the compromise was that it would have an international administration. At that time, and that was something that neither of them liked. Georges Picot, because France's sort of kind of imperial identity was quite closely tied up with protecting Christians in the Holy Land. They'd done that under a deal they struck with the Ottomans again about 400 years earlier, and the British wanted it because Sykes's concept was of a sort of cordon across the Middle East from Egypt, which was already under British control, all the way to the Iranian frontier. And the idea was to create what he called a belt of English-controlled country that ran across the Middle East and kept essentially all Britain's rivals away from the approaches to India.
Yeah.
So that was the deal.
And so this is the famous, I could say infamous, Sykes-Picot agreement, which to some extent, it's almost gained more significance in its ongoing reputation than it ever really had in reality. Is that a fair judgment?
That is absolutely fair, because it was essentially a diplomatic sticking plaster. It was done because of the concern about the Entente Cordiale. Georges Picot had managed to worry the British enough that if they didn't cut some sort of deal, then the whole future of the alliance was at stake. And in 1915, there were some serious worries about whether France really had it in itself to carry on fighting because of the number of casualties that the French army had sustained, and there'd been mutinies and so on. So there was a real concern underlying it. But the deal was obviously, it was drawn on a map that's about 3 foot by 3 foot and coloured in coloured pencil. And I don't think anyone really at the time felt that it was going to shape the Middle East in the way it did. I mean, there's an argument about this. Some people will look at all of the sort of lines on it and say, look, most of this didn't come to pass. But the core, the core operating principle of it was that Britain and France would rule the Middle East after the war. And that is then what actually happened.
That is what happened. Yeah. You mentioned that they couldn't reach agreement on Israel and Palestine, and there was an idea for some kind of an international administration. And obviously, we're going to go on to talk about another significant sort of historic decision or declaration momentarily. But what was envisaged for that? The concept of international administration,
yes,
in the early 20th century was quite a novel one. So what did they have in mind for the sort of what was then known as Palestine?
Well, I think it was, you know, it was really quite vague. I mean, there'd been the status of Jerusalem had been an issue which was part of one of the causes of the Crimean War, you know, during the 19th century. Yeah. But I don't think it was a fix. It wasn't, no one had really thought that carefully about exactly who would rule Jerusalem. And when the question actually then became a material one after Britain took Jerusalem in December 1917 and General Allenby, the victorious general, marched in, Georges Picot was hot on his heels. He was actually in the party that arrived in Jerusalem for this famous entry into the Holy City in just before Christmas 1917, and he raised the question of the government of the city, and the British fended him off by saying, well, this is still a war zone, and there's a military administration really until the war ends, because no one really quite knew what was going to happen, and the British certainly didn't want to share the government of the place with the French.
Yeah, and it's a classic example of the difference between a sort of diplomatic principles and facts on the ground. So let's go on. You mentioned December 1917. Well, just a month earlier, a letter had been written, a famous letter from Arthur Balfour to Lord Rothschild. And I'm just going to read the opening paragraph. I have much pleasure, dear Lord Rothschild, I have much pleasure in conveying to you on behalf of His Majesty's government the following declaration of sympathy with Jewish Zionist aspirations, which has been submitted to and approved by the Cabinet. The Balfour Declaration. So can you explain as best you can, what is the Balfour Declaration and what was its context?
So the Balfour Declaration was quite simply a declaration of British government support for the idea of Zionism and the idea of a Jewish national home. It arose straight out of the Sykes-Picot Agreement, because as soon as it was clear that Britain hadn't got what it wanted strategically out of Sykes-Picot, it hadn't got Israel-Palestine, and there was this gap in the cordon that Sykes and others envisaged, they started looking around for an alternative idea. Sykes himself was hugely anti-Semitic, even by the standards of that era. People noted that he was an anti-Semite. Mm. And he had quite exaggerated ideas about Jewish influence. And so he began to wonder whether the Jews might, you know, by supporting the Zionists, might sort of be able to bring, you know, the Jewish diaspora around the world in on, you know, behind the British. But there were other ideas as well behind it. So, I mean, one of them was the fact that Britain was finding it quite hard to raise money on Wall Street to fund the war. Obviously, financing the war was critically important. And there's an element of truth in this. We've got to be very, very careful. But essentially, because Britain was allied to Russia through the French.
Yeah.
And because Russia was so anti-Semitic.
And this is pre-revolutionary Russia, of course.
This is pre-revolutionary Russia. So, you know, there were Jewish bankers in the United States who were not, you know, anxious to lend them money. And in fact, were, you know, anxious to try to stop that from happening. So that, you know, that was an issue lurking behind the scenes. Then there was the question of the United States itself, because of course, in 1917, they joined the Allied war effort. They declared war, and very soon after they did so, they were briefed on the existence of the Sykes-Picot Agreement. And when Colonel House, who was President Wilson's foreign policy advisor, found out about it, he said, "It is all bad, and I told them so." The American reaction to Sykes-Picot was very negative when they heard about it. So Britain knew that it needed to outwit the French, to sort of to deal with American concerns, they needed to come up with a better basis for British rule of what is now Israel-Palestine. And so the Balfour Declaration was the device they used to achieve that.
And the phrase is used, His Majesty's government with favour the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people. Now, what is a national home? Does that mean a country? Does it mean a colony governed by Britain? Do we have an understanding of what they meant at that time?
I don't think we do. One of the interesting things about this is that the people, including Balfour, who actually supported the declaration, a lot of them had been, they came from the sort of fringes of Britain and were a particular kind of Protestant often. And of course, sort of in lurking in Protestant theology going back into the 19th century was this idea that, you know, the Christians should help the Jews return to Israel, to the promised land. So that was a kind of, that was powerful. It's very hard. I find it very hard now to sort of understand just how important that was compared to the strategic aspects of this, because there's no question that when people emphasized the sort of more spiritual side of things, they were told, you know, rewrite the memo so that you get the strategic stuff in first. You see that very, very clearly. So that was that. So I don't think they really, I don't think they knew. I think, like, as with the promise that they made to the Sharif of Mecca, they were sort of feeling their way forward, wondering what was the minimum they could offer that would have the maximum possible response. How would it be interpreted? And so they came up with Jewish National Home. And of course, the second half of the declaration said that it had to be without prejudice to the rights of the non-Jewish inhabitants, as the declaration put it.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And presumably at that time, the number of Jews in Palestine was still very small.
It was tiny, tens of thousands at the very most. So a very small number of people.
Yeah. So let's jump forward a little. Obviously, World War One came to an end. Both the Ottomans and the Germans were defeated. The Ottoman Empire collapsed. And whilst it wasn't quite the same status as other colonies such as India or territories in Africa, effectively, the line drawn on the Sykes-Picot map morphed into British colonies in Iraq, Jordan and Palestine, and French colonies in Lebanon and Syria.
Yeah, exactly. That was all sort of stitched up in about 1920. The post-war discussions were increasingly rancorous. And I mean, very soon after the war, the British managed to get the French to agree that Palestine would come under British control, as would northern Iraq, because by then they'd worked out that there was oil in northern Iraq that they wanted.
Right.
Because they were so unsure of the American attitude, the sort of American anti-imperialism had really spooked the British. And the war was won on American oil. It was American oil from the Western Hemisphere, which had fueled the Allied war effort in Western Europe in the First World War. And so the British were looking for, you know, sources of supply of their own where the Americans wouldn't be able to, to influence them so much. So once the British had decided they wanted Iraq, then they realized that the quid pro quo for that had to be that French would control Lebanon and Syria. And of course, that cut across the promise that they had made to Sharif Hussein during the war to get him to revolt, because Lebanon and Syria were part of that Arab
part
empire.
Of the promise. Yeah.
So it was all very awkward. But Balfour famously said, during the Paris peace negotiations, that if they had to offend one side or another, it was better that they offended the Arabs rather than the French. And the reason for that was because by the end of the Paris peace conference and when the Versailles Treaty was eventually signed, it was pretty clear to people that this wasn't going to solve anything. There would be another war at some point, and Britain's assumption at that point, which was rather confounded come the Second World War, of course, was that they needed to have the French on side. So it was the French, French interests prevailed.
Yeah. And so the territories that then sort of took shape under British rule, Iraq, I think it was called Transjordan and Palestine, the borders that existed between those different so-called mandates, did they correspond to previous Ottoman borders, or how was that map sort of divvied up?
The Ottoman Empire in the east was divided up into much smaller provinces. And in fact, at one point, the British did think about basing post-war rule on the Ottoman sort of provincial boundaries, but then changed their minds when the French got involved. So it didn't exactly correspond. I couldn't honestly say exactly how where the boundaries were, but essentially these were new entities. And if you look at the sort of the angular nature of places like Jordan and the eastern the western borders of Iraq, show you this was all done.
Straight lines.
It's a modern
drawn on a map.
It's straight lines on a map, and it doesn't really even, it doesn't reflect the Syrian desert is not something that is, it's a rather featureless, undulating place without, much to many features on it. But, the lines run straight across it.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's return to what is called Palestine at that time in the sort of 1920s and 30s, did the Balfour Declaration have a significant impact on Jewish emigration or Jewish return, if you like, to the what was the historic land of Israel?
So there was Jewish immigration after at the end of the First World War. It did have some effect. But the problem was that Palestine was a backwater. I mean, it was barely farmed. It was relatively sparsely populated at that time. Mm. There were serious diseases like malaria present. And so the work in Palestine at the beginning was backbreaking. Frankly, there was a lot of stone breaking to be done before you could, make a living farming. But of course, the kinds of people who were coming, the kinds of Jewish people who wanted to escape Europe and find something better, tended to live in towns and cities where they were, they were persecuted. They weren't farmers at all. They were urbanites.
Yeah.
And so they arrived in Palestine and, were handed a rake or something like that, and it wasn't it wasn't what they weren't that wasn't their skill, and it certainly wasn't what they particularly wanted to do. So in fact, during the 20s at times there was actually net Jewish emigration from Palestine. So people came and then they saw how desperate it was, and they left again.
Right.
It's only in the 1930s, when obviously the political situation in Europe changes, that significant numbers of Jews started to come.
And throughout that time, what was the status of the land that these people occupied? Because clearly, there is a population there already, as Balfour recognised, as is just evident from any bit of history. So were people buying land? Were they acquiring it in some other way? They were being assigned land. What was happening?
They were buying land. Just to come back to something you said, that's very interesting, is that actually the big question is, did Balfour really realise who was there and so on? Because I think Balfour visited, I think, finally in the mid-20s, and apocryphally there's this story that he was sort of confronted by lots of people. I guess he came, he went to Jerusalem. Certainly there were plenty of protests wherever he went, but he was apparently flabbergasted by the people he saw, because I suppose in a way, I've got a Bible here that I've had for years, and it's sort of, you know, it's got pictures of things like the sort of the burning bush and all the illustrations in a Bible. If you go back, you know, to a 19th century Bible or something like that, tend to sort of show desert and emptiness. And if you think of the pictures that David Roberts, you know, the famous Victorian, you know, watercolorist, you know, they're all sorts of, they're kind of rather empty landscapes with people looking contemplatively into the distance. And I think, you know, this sort of rubs off, that essentially the people who divided up the Middle East in the First World War didn't really appreciate that there was a, you know, there was an urban Arab Palestinian population living there. And that, you know, there and this prejudice prevails, and it still, you know, goes on today, that there's this assumption that Arabs are people who will move. You know, the whole concept of being Arab is mobility.
Yeah.
And you see this going right back. I mean, right back to the first time that the Arabs acquire that label. It's really sort of during Roman times, but it's not quite clear what the Romans mean by it, but there's definitely a kind of concept of these are people who can up sticks and go. And that continues all the way through. So there's always this assumption that, you know, that there'll be space because the Arabs can move if necessary. And that underlies a lot of what's happened in the 20th century. So that was my thought about Balfour and where we're...
Just on that point, to explore that a little, is that partly because, you know, the word Arab is used to, obviously, to describe people who use the Arabic language as their first language. And for example, you know, in 20th century Saudi Arabia, before the oil boom, it was a largely sort of nomadic pastoralist society, whereas actually the Levant, the region of what is now Syria, Lebanon and Palestine, had urbanization much earlier on. So it's partly just the fact that we're using this one word to describe some very different types of societies.
I think that's absolutely right. That, yeah, and going right back, Arab was used in this slightly kind of, what's the word, diffuse way, or, you know, the same word was used to describe groups of people in rather different settings, but always people who were sort of on the margins of the urbanized world. But of course, by the 20th century, that wasn't the case. You know, this was, you know, the Middle East in general was the earliest urbanized society west of Iran, anyway, discounting the Indian civilizations. But, you know, so a high degree of urbanization, but somehow this was rather ignored along the way.
Yeah. So we were talking about the land situation before World War II, when Jews went to what is the historic land of Israel, how are they getting land? How are they acquiring this?
So they were buying it, and they were buying it from big Arab landowners, some of whom were in quite a lot of financial distress at that time. Yeah. So there were significant, and there always had been, these sort of notables, they're sort of known as, who tended to live in the towns in Syria, but owned estates that were often quite spread about. It wasn't necessarily contiguous bits of land, parcels of land, but they had parcels here and there. Now, the creation of the frontier, you know, between British and French controlled territory, made the job of supervising their land holdings a little bit more tricky at times, particularly when there were periods of sort of disturbance and the border crossings became tricky. So landowners started to sell up, and they often, you know, they found willing purchasers in the Jewish community who wanted to buy the land and wanted to try and make the most of it.
Yeah.
The British, I think, tried to restrict this. So in 1929, there were riots, which started over an access dispute to the Western Wall, the Wailing Wall of the Temple, the last remaining bit of Herod's temple. And at that time, nowadays that's a big plaza, but of course back then there was a very, essentially the plaza was an Algerian, there was an Algerian quarter there, and lots of very, very dense housing. And the wall itself was essentially one side of a narrow alleyway. And there was an argument over access because people wanted to put up screens to segregate male and female worshippers, all that sort of thing. And it was basically a right of way issue. Anyway, like a lot of these things do, it started something sort of trivial and ended up enormous with people being murdered. And as a result of that, the British did start to restrict. They realized that immigration was an issue. And although their plan to limit immigration was pushed back by Zionist lobbying, essentially, and the Labour, Ramsay MacDonald's Labour government didn't want to go there. They did, I think, restrict land sales to try to take some of the pressure off, and sort of remove some of the causes of discontent.
You've mentioned how life was pretty tough in that pre-war period, and in fact that there was net emigration out of what was then Palestine. Clearly, the events of World War II changes everything, and the horrific sort of crime of the Holocaust in Europe. But what was actually happening in sort of military terms in those territories during World War II?
Well, I suppose just before that, the there was a huge Arab revolt in the 1930s, and that drew in a large number of British troops. And so the British dealt with the rebels with enormous brutality, but managed through censorship to conceal a lot of what went on. And we're only really finding out about some of the extent of that, relatively recently. But come 1940 or so, there was a situation where the French authorities in Beirut and Damascus had backed Vichy. Partly because of the degree of ill will that there'd been between the wars, between the British and the French authorities, because both sides had faced uprisings. The rebels in each case had crossed the border and used sort of space on the other side of the frontier to organize themselves. And when that happened in Syria, the British refused to help the French. And when it happened in Palestine, the French refused to help the British. So there was plenty of bad blood on both sides. But particularly, I think the French felt that the British had been very uncooperative.
Yeah.
So they backed Vichy. And Palestine was essentially it was a kind of backwater. It was the sort of place you went, for R&R if you were on, fighting in the Western Desert.
Yeah.
In the North Africa campaign. And it was relatively quiet because at that point, although the Jews were increasingly fed up with British rule, obviously they realised that Hitler posed the greater danger. So they just had to sort of sit quiet for the time being. But in 1941, the Vichy government allowed German Luftwaffe to use air bases in Syria to support an Arab uprising in Iraq. And that was the point at which the British decided they could not sort of leave things as they were any longer.
Yeah.
And so in sort of June 1941, a combined British, Australian and Free French force invaded Lebanon and Syria. There was a sort of month-long, rather vicious war. And the result of it was that the Vichy forces capitulated and de Gaulle took over. So he took over Lebanon, the running of Lebanon and Syria. But because he was so short-staffed, he had to re-employ a lot of the people who had worked for the Vichy government, who swapped sides and joined him, but who bore considerable ill will towards the British.
Yeah, and if I'm not mistaken, there are still Palestinians alive today who fought under British command in that campaign.
That right. It wouldn't surprise me. I always think this is sort of longer ago than it was. It is within living memory because it's 80 years ago.
Yeah.
So there are very old men and women who remember this, remember this time.
Yeah. So another thing that was happening at that time was that you had the former Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, a sort of significant figure in a kind of Islamic hierarchy, Hajj Amin al-Husseini, who'd fallen foul of the Brits during the revolt that you mentioned, and he by this time had a sort of sided with the Axis powers, hadn't he? And I think he was operating out of Berlin as a kind of propagandist.
He'd washed up in Berlin, exactly. He was one of the Husseinis were the, you know, with the Nashashibis, they were sort of two of the three big Jerusalem families, and he'd been the Grand Mufti since the 20s, and that gave him command of various charitable sort of funds and enabled him to raise money and boost his own reputation. He ended up essentially running the Arab revolt and pushing people around. He was then exiled by the British and he ended up outside Beirut for a while. But then, as you say, he washed up in Berlin where, of course, the Nazis sort of embraced him and wondered whether they could reprise the whole idea of the Holy War that they had thought about in the First World War. He was out there doing that. And then eventually he ended up in Paris in 1946 and then mysteriously escaped house arrest. Essentially what happened was the French realized they just didn't want him. And so he was allowed to escape, I think, on a sort of false Egyptian passport or something like that.
Yeah. But the rather sort of painful overlap of kind of extreme fascistic anti-Semitism and then an Arab anti-Semitism that is obviously very hostile to Jewish immigration into Palestine. Does that sort of start there?
It possibly goes back ever so slightly further, because of course there were sort of fascistic groups or groups that looked very much like, you know, the brown shirts and stuff, operating, say, in Syria from the 30s onwards. There's the sort of Syrian Arab nationalists generally were sort of oddly attracted to what was going on in both Italy and Germany. And so some of it was rather comical. I think people didn't really take it that seriously in the 30s. There's a sort of famous picture of a group of Syrian sort of these, I've forgotten what they were called, the Iron Shirts, I think. They were very sort of, you know, real sort of similar stuff.
Yeah.
But they're all standing on sort of school, like sort of chairs, and giving sort of Nazi style salutes, but it all looks slightly sort of pathetic, slightly comical rather than alarming.
It's a little bit Roderick Spode's brown shorts or whatever they're called, you know.
Exactly. And people said the same about King Faisal. So Lawrence of Arabia's wartime, you know, comrade ended up as king of Iraq because the British had put him there. People said that he was rather lucky to have died in 1933 because he was also showing some interest in all this sort of ideology. And you know, his reputation might have suffered if he'd lived longer than he did.
Yeah. And then you had the Falange militia in Lebanon, didn't you, which modelled itself originally on, I think, the Spanish fascists.
Exactly. And then the Syrian, was it Syrian Socialist Party, who have a kind of like a sort of three pronged swastika, as you know, it's like a red, white and black flag with a sort of swastika type device on it. Yeah, there's lots of things which are, you know, not too pleasant. And of course, and that has, you know, and it did. I mean, they, you know, there were unfortunately Arabs who thought that, you know, my enemy's enemy is my friend, and therefore thought Hitler was a good thing.
Yeah, indeed. So obviously we have the horrific events of the Holocaust, and that completely changes the equation of what's happening in these lands that we're talking about. I mean, is that right? Clearly, the moral case for there being a state of Israel is completely built around the responsibility of Europe for the Holocaust. Is that how you see it from as a sort of historian trying to understand the development of these events?
Yes, no, it is. And I think it is increasingly, actually. I think in the sense that the Balfour Declaration, which Israel did, you know, mark back in 2017 on the centenary, is a really rocky foundation for a state, given that, you know, there's anti-Semitic ideas lurking in it, and it's a sort of, you know, it's the result of a bit of British clever thinking that went wrong, really. So that's not very solid. But the Holocaust changed everything, because Clearly, it produced sympathy across Europe, but it also produced guilt. I think that that's almost as important. And when you particularly look at, say, the attitude of the French in supporting the young Israeli state, I think that the motives for the French for doing so, they're quite complicated. But one of them, of course, is the role that the French played in the Holocaust and the fact that, you know, they had rounded up French Jews and sent them off to their deaths during the war.
Yeah.
But also, of course, then French Jews who'd escaped that played a pretty significant role in the resistance. And so yeah. France was it was an interesting country in which after the war, there were these Jewish networks that had been used for resistance activity during the war, were then in a position where they could run guns to Palestine and then Israel as it became, but also organize emigration, organize people smuggling of people who had survived the death camps or just avoided them out of Central Eastern Europe, where they were living in fairly horrendous conditions in these displaced persons camps. These people were all coming west, arriving in France, where they were helped to leave for Palestine.
Thank you for listening to the first of these special episodes on the history of the Israel-Palestine conflict. In the next episode, we'll learn more about Jewish militancy in the mid-20th century, the events of 1948, including the Nakba, and of course the establishment of the State of Israel. If you found this episode interesting and useful, please give us a positive review and don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss any more episodes. Behind the Lines is produced by me, Arthur Snell, and the theme tune is by Matty Benbrook.
This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.